China has rebuked the United States again over House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. It has accused Washington of playing with fire and pledges to punish those who offend Beijing. Iran's atomic energy chief says Tehran injected gas into advanced centrifuges in response to new U.S. sanctions, but within the legal framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Russia warns that it could use its nuclear arsenal in response to direct involvement of NATO countries over the Ukraine conflict. Well, welcome to the studio here in the capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. China has rebuked the United States again over House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. It has accused Washington of playing with fire and pledges to punish those who offend Beijing.
Those who play with fire will not come to a good end, and those who offend China will be punished.
Wang Yi said Washington is breaching China's sovereignty under the pretext of so-called democracy. He made the remarks before the end of Pelosi's controversial trip to Taiwan. During her talk with Taiwan's president, Pelosi reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to supporting the island. The Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen, for her part, said the island will not back down in the face of military drills that China has launched in response to Pelosi's trip. Beijing has announced a series of military exercises around Taiwan, saying the maneuvers are aimed at protecting China's territorial integrity.
The Chinese military's conducting of military exercises in the sea near China's Taiwan are a necessary and just measure to resolutely protect national sovereignty and territorial integrity in response to the major provocative moves by some U.S. politicians and Taiwan independence forces.
Hu or Hua Chunying called the U.S. provocateur and said Washington is to blame for the current tensions. She added that China has repeatedly warned the U.S. against the House Speaker's visit to the island, but that Washington brushed aside those warnings. Nancy Pelosi, who is on her East Asia tour, landed in Taipei last evening and has now left for South Korea. Prior to her one-day trip to Taiwan, Washington said that Pelosi is entitled to travel to the island. China sees Taiwan as part of its territory and is opposed to Washington's growing engagement with the island. Wilma Leon is a columnist and political scientist who joins us. Well, there you have it. So Nancy Pelosi has made her trip to Chinese Taipei. What do you think of that trip, first of all? And as a consequence, how do you see China's reaction so far to her trip?
Well, I think that Speaker Pelosi's trip was provocative and senseless, and therefore making it irresponsible and incredibly dangerous. I don't know what she expected to accomplish by taking this trip. All she did was really aggravate the Chinese, and the Chinese reaction, I think, up to this point, has been incredibly temperate. They have warned the United States very clearly that those who play with fire will be burned by it, and that in that they leave themselves open to whatever response they choose to use. I think it's important to understand that China is not going to be baited into a response a la shooting down her plane. Their response is going to be measured. It's going to be a response that they deem to be in their best interest, and in the time frame that they see fit. The question, though, to me, the bigger question is not so much Nancy Pelosi as it is Joe Biden. Why didn't Joe Biden stop this fiasco? Why didn't he stop this irresponsible, reckless provocation? As the President of the United States, who told us during the campaign that he was going to lead with diplomacy, he has failed. He's leading with provocation. He never should have allowed this to happen.
Does it have anything to do with the midterms?
Of course it has. It has a lot to do with midterms. The problem is, it's the wrong move. If they want to impact the midterms and the American electorate in a positive manner, do something about inflation. Do something about the living wage. Do something about health care. Lower prices on pharmaceuticals. Do the things that he promised he would do during on the campaign trail, instead of traversing the world, bringing us to the brink of World War III, whether it be the provocation in Ukraine, whether it be the provocation in Taiwan, or, hey, Joe, here's an idea. Why don't you get the JCPOA done? Do some things that tamp down aggression, don't fan the flames of conflict.
Well, when you take a look at the situation, as you said, it's for the wrong reasons or no reasons that you can see for there to be an achievement of any kind for the U.S. side, at least as far as we can see here. But when it comes to the Chinese response, we're looking at Xi Jinping, who's seeking her third term. And so far, the response has been this military exercises that basically, from what I see on a map right now, is they're revolving around the island. Do you think that is a strong enough response? Because he can't look weak, can he?
Well, I think what we always have to remember, I think the Chinese government is a lot like your government. Very thoughtful, temperate, and tends to act on its own timeline. Who was it that had the phrase, you have the watches, but we have the time? So by encircling the island, Xi Jinping could very well be preparing for an invasion of the island. I don't know. By encircling the island, he could be imposing an economic blockade on the island. So, you know, we can't measure Xi Jinping's response by a Western standard. We have to measure his response by a Chinese standard. And it's also important to realize that now Russia is on record saying that they may offer support if asked by China. So I think there are a lot of things going on here behind the scenes that the United States is ill prepared to deal with.
We're really on there, columnist and political scientist. Thank you so much. Well, we have talked to political commentator Syed Mustafa Khoshchesh about growing tensions between the U.S. and China over Taiwan. He believes the U.S. tries to bully all countries, including China, which it regards as enemies.
Americans deal with all their foes and rivals the same way. They try to bully and humiliate all those rivals and the states that are called as rogue states or enemy states, whatever they call, they try to humiliate and bully them. It doesn't make any difference if you're China, if you're Iran, if you're Russia. They try to impose their will on you, and be it in the negotiations over the war of tariff between the United States and China, or territorial integrity of China. It doesn't make any difference. The tactics they've been using against East European countries when they staged Velvet Revolutions were again repeated in Baghdad, embassy of the United States. The same was done in Hong Kong. And the same thing that they've been doing to all other enemies, they are now doing to China in Taiwan. It's not just the Biden administration or Nancy Pelosi. Under Donald Trump, the same strategy was underway, and they have continued the same kind of humiliation and the same kind of bullying tactics against Chinese.
Iran says the delegation will leave for Vienna in a few hours to resume negotiations on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the negotiating team is led by Ali Bagherikani, adding the talks are set to be held as part of the country's policy of removing sanctions. The spokesman says the negotiations will take place in coordination with the European Union. Kanani reiterated Iran's insistence on a sustainable agreement that guarantees the rights and interests of the Iranian nation. He expressed hope that the other side would take necessary decisions to resolve the remaining issues. Meanwhile, the EU coordinator said that he is heading to Vienna for the talks. The deal was derailed after Washington pulled out of it in 2018. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April of last year. The talks failed to make breakthroughs due to what Iran calls the U.S. failure to show goodwill and its excessive demands. Meanwhile, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country has injected gas into advanced centrifuges response to new U.S. sanctions, but within the legal framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Mohammad Islami ensured that Tehran will continue to honor the NPT guidelines. However, he accused the U.S. of continuing its so-called maximum pressure policy, despite admitting its failure. He said that Iran signed the 2015 deal and agreed to certain limits on its nuclear activities to alleviate Western concerns. The AEOI chief explained that the U.S. not only failed to fulfill its own commitments under the deal, but it rather continued to magnify false accusations that it has been leveling against Iran for over two decades. He said the U.S. and some of its allies, including Israel, often cite fake documents to intensify pressure on the Iranian nation. On Monday, the U.S. imposed sanctions on six companies over the accusations that they helped Iran export petrochemical products. Iran's defense ministry has displayed its various products during an exhibition in Tehran titled The Defense Ministry's Capabilities in Knowledge-Based Production and Economy. Saman Kujuri reports.
Iran's defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy. The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition.
The ministry's management team has been cooperating with more than 6,000 knowledge-based companies. The localization of products, expanding in-depth knowledge and technology, and creating synergy among the relevant institutions are on the ministry's agenda. The Defense Ministry is responsible for empowering and upgrading Iran's defense industry capabilities while using its knowledge to contribute to production of non-military products.
Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states. Because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art, weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The U.S. is calling for Argentina to seize the Venezuelan cargo plane grounded in Buenos Aires since June. The U.S. Justice Department says the plane has been sold by Iran's Mahan Air to Venezuela's Imtrasur company. The department says that's in violation of U.S. export control laws because both airlines are under sanction. The plane has been stuck in Argentina since June 8. That is when it tried to fly to Uruguay but was denied entry. On Monday, Argentina's federal judge ordered the departure of a dozen of 19 crew members, who include Iranians and Venezuelans. Last week, Iran summoned Argentina's envoy, calling for the departure of its nationals. Tehran says the Iranian trainers are on board the plane in accordance with international aviation regulations. Russia has accused NATO countries of what it calls a fierce hybrid confrontation against the country. That, Moscow says, dangerously balances the edge of open military clash. Russia says it stands for preventing the clash, but it will not back down if the West tries to test Moscow's resolve. Those comments were made by a senior Russian foreign ministry official at the UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Conference. Alexander Trofimov also said the conflict in Ukraine does not warrant Russia's use of nuclear weapons, but he added Moscow could use its nuclear arsenal in response to direct aggression by NATO. In the meantime, Russian Defense Ministry has accused the U.S. of direct involvement in the Ukraine war. The ministry has referred to comments by a Ukrainian official about the way that Kiev had used Washington's HIMARS or HIMARS rocket system launches based on real-time information. The Election Commission of Pakistan has ruled that the party of former Prime Minister Imran Khan has received funds from prohibited sources, including foreign nationals and foreign companies. The ruling could put the former international cricket star turned politician in further trouble after he was ousted from power in April in a vote of no confidence. Kamran Yusuf has the details.
It took the Election Commission of Pakistan 7 years to conclude the illegal funding case against the party of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The case that was filed by one of the founding members of Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party maintained that his party received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities. In a 70-page judgment, the Election Commission confirmed that Tehreek-e-Insaf was guilty and concealed 16 bank accounts through which it accepted donations from foreigners or foreign groups.
I thank God that our 8-year struggle has paid off. I have no personal interest in this case. This is in the national interest that Pakistani political parties and their leadership must be subservient to the law.
The Election Commission also ruled that the former Prime Minister submitted false statements regarding his party's funding, but the party of Imran Khan has dismissed the charges.
We have been saying all along that this is not a case of foreign funding, but prohibited funding. Today's ruling has vindicated our stance that our political party has received no foreign funding.
The ruling comes over 3 months after Khan lost his office in a vote of no confidence in April. But Khan still insists he was ousted from power through a US-backed conspiracy.
Was there any crisis in the country when the US toppled our government? And those responsible in Pakistan to stop this conspiracy have acted as mere spectators.
Despite being ousted from power, Khan's popularity has increased. This was reflected in by-elections held recently in Punjab, where Khan's party swept the polls. The unexpected victory by Khan's party has allowed them to regain control of Punjab province.
There is no immediate fallout of the Election Commission's ruling on Khan and his party. Nevertheless, findings of the Election Commission may lead to legal challenges for the former Prime Minister. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Imam Baghir, peace be upon him, said, "Pilgrimage of the tomb of the Messenger of God and the martyrs, and pilgrimage of Imam Hussein's tomb, equals to an accepted Hajj that has been performed in the company of the Messenger of God."
In the limelight.
A recent report from Al Mizan Center for Human Rights shows that from January 2022 to early July, the Israeli regime navy carried out more than 225 attacks against Palestinian fishers, up from 195 during that same period in 2021. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Amjad Ayman Yaghi Ryder. This article is published under the heading "Brutalized at Sea: Palestinian Fishers Quit Due to Zionist Regime Attacks." Stay tuned for more. On the morning of June 16th, Majid Fakhri Baker went fishing off the coast of Beach Refugee Camp along with his nephew and another relative. As a member of a well-known fishing family, Majid, 38, had been in the industry for 18 years. Yet after that June morning, he decided to quit the fishing business entirely. While they collected fish from their nets, an Israeli regime naval vessel approached Majid's small boat. The fisher said loudly, "We are fishers who just want to fish." Majid said he couldn't make out their faces. He just saw individuals in tactical gear and sunglasses. The Israeli regime naval vessel rammed Majid's boat and opened fire on the men with rubber bullets. Majid was knocked off his feet and collided with an iron pole in the middle of the boat. His nephew Nasser, 18, was hit by a rubber bullet in the left shoulder. Yet it was the other man on the boat, Muhammad, 27, who sustained the most serious injuries from rubber bullets. Muhammad was taken to Al-Shifa Hospital due to severe bleeding in the pelvic area. He is still receiving treatment for his injuries in the form of painkillers and periodic injections of antibiotics. It is just past peak season for Israeli regime violations against Palestinian fishers, according to Nezar Ayash, the chairman of the Fishers Syndicate in Gaza. He said that the fishing season, which runs from April to June, constitutes about 40 to 50% of the annual output of the fishing sector in Gaza, so it's no surprise that Israeli regime violations are concentrated around these months. He has observed that such violations against Palestinian fishers are systematic, timed to occur during the month when fishers could be bringing in their biggest hauls. A recent report from Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights shows that from January 2022 to early July, the Israeli regime navy carried out more than 225 attacks against Palestinian fishers, up from 195 during that same period in 2021. The Zionist regime arbitrarily arrested 41 Palestinian fishers, including 7 children, and injured more than 16, including 3 children, during the first half of 2022. For Majid, this was not his first journey while fishing. On at least 5 other occasions, he has endured injuries at the hands of the Israeli regime navy. Like in 2004, when Israeli regime naval vessels shot water from a high-powered hose at his boat and he fell and hit his head. Even on a day when fishers do not directly encounter the Israeli regime navy, there is always the anticipation of violence and danger, and precautions must be taken. Majid said, "While fishing, we often lower the lights in the evenings to protect ourselves from the Israeli regime cruisers firing. This makes it difficult to see in the dark and to pull in the nets." One time, Majid had to abandon his haul of the day when an Israeli regime vessel pulled up and, through a megaphone, demanded he leave at once. Most often, the voices through the megaphones command in Arabic a simple "go." Majid has repeatedly appealed to human rights organizations to help stop the Israeli regime violations against fishers, but these efforts have been in vain. The violations continue unabated. Because of such unchecked attacks, which continued throughout the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, some of Gaza's fishers have decided the risks of the profession are too great. Athamso P-35 is one of them. He quit fishing to work in residential construction. So P's 20-member family primarily relies on fishing for income, yet the family's economic situation has deteriorated in recent years. Three of his brothers have been laid off, and since getting married 7 years ago, Sopi has faced a reproductive issue and doesn't have the funds for treatment. The family lives in a simple four-room house in the Gaza City neighborhood of Sheikh Radwan. Sopi, who has worked as a fisher since he was 15, said the Israeli regime naval blockade presents a major hindrance to Gaza's fishers, most of whom have no other career path besides fishing. Yet Sopi chose to work in construction rather than die at the sea. Many times I would not tell my wife about the Israeli regime violations we the fishers are subjected to, so she wouldn't worry about me, he said. Faiz Allah, 38, from Khan Yunus, also quit fishing and sold his boat. His last fishing trip was on June 25th. He was pulling his nets from the sea when a bullet hit the water. Allah was unsure whether it was live ammunition or rubber bullets, but the Israeli regime navy was opening fire at his boat and others off the coast of Khan Yunus. Allah was lucky to get out of the situation uninjured, but the horrifying sensation of near death follows him. He's currently looking for a new line of work. I have experienced the same incident before when a bullet was shot near me, he said, adding, the same thing happened to me again in April. It was a signal that I had to quit this profession so I can stay alive for my children, he said. I don't know what the days ahead will bring, but I won't work in fishing as long as the Israeli regime occupation continues preventing us. Ayyash, the chairman of the Fisher Syndicate, said that Gaza is witnessing one of the longest naval blockades in history. Since 2015, he said, the Zionist regime has confiscated about 45 small fishing boats or hasakets. In the past 2 months, the Israeli regime has confiscated 15 larger boats. Such confiscations may last for years, he said, but if the boats are returned, they are returned without engines and fishing equipment, essentially rendering them defunct. There are fishers who work as daily paid laborers to only get paid 20 shekels, he said. Due to Israeli regime violations, they sometimes return home without fishing or don't receive their daily wages, as the fishing profession depends on how much fish is caught. Many of those who quit fishing are currently looking for work, he said. This could mean economic ruin for the families who support themselves through fishing, such as Majid. As one of the most renowned fishing families in the Gaza Strip, Majid has lived and worked by sea for decades, operating out of the beach refugee camp west of Gaza City, where they live in an area known as Bigger Land. The sea is full of secrets and abundant, endless sustenance, Majid said. Fishing is not only a source of income for the family, but also a passion they have passed down through the generations, so all the children will have a source of livelihood. Now, as each day at sea brings more injuries and destruction due to the occupation, Gaza's fishing families have to wonder what will they bequeath to their children.
علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him,
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 16th sermon, when Imam Ali alayhi salam lays down the strategy which he had in taking over the government, and he explains that strategy, which was quite painful for some, but for some it was a breath of fresh, or it was a breeze of fresh air, of freedom and progress and felicity. And this was something that Imam Ali alayhi salam definitely wanted to take forward. One of those plans that Imam Ali alayhi salam was the plan that وَلَا يُقَصِّرَنَّ السَّبَّاقُونَ كَانُوا سَبَقُوا, that we will definitely reduce or stop the progress of those who wished to go ahead, whose aim was just to achieve a specific social position or a particular material goal, and their aim was not something further than that. They just wanted that position. These people will be stopped. And people that want position for progress, who aim for greatness of the society, who have a higher aim, who have a lofty objective, will be given those position, in other words.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
So we've been talking about this specific important strategy that Imam Ali alayhi salam had, and that is to stop and reduce the progress, or rather, reduce the opportunities for those people who unfortunately just seek material positions without actually contemplating on the reasons behind what they want. They just want to enjoy it for its material benefits. These people will definitely, Imam Ali says that they will not be given the opportunity because they do not deserve it, while those who deserve will be given those opportunities. This is Imam Ali. This is the man of justice. This is the voice of human justice. Or rather, he is not only the voice of human justice, this is the voice of divine justice, from the voice of a human being like Imam Ali alayhi salam. In these 25 years before Imam Ali alayhi salam took up the caliphate, after the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam passed away, there was a gap of 25 years. In these 25 years, Imam Ali alayhi salam was silent. He was patient. He was waiting for the right time. Suddenly, this window of light opens up, and the door opens, and there's a sudden freshness that comes and overwhelms the Muslim Ummah. Here is when Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَاللَّهِ مَا كَتَمْتُ وَشْمَةً that by Allah, I have not hidden even the very little, even a speck. I have said whatever was necessary. وَلَا كَذِبْتُ كِذْبَةً And neither have I lied, even the slightest form of lie. This strategy that Imam Ali al-Salam says is a very important strategy that he's going to follow. And the predictions that he made were very accurate because of that special position that he had. وَلَقَدْ نُبِئْتُ بِهَذَا الْمَقَامِ وَهَذَا الْيَوْمِ Imam Ali al-Salam comes and says that I was definitely told and informed about this position and this day. This position means, and this day means the day where I can see the Muslim Ummah has been reduced to such a position. I certainly was informed about this. Now, whether this information was because of a certain connection with the realm of the unseen, which was definitely there, or was it because of his deep awareness of the rules and laws that govern the progress of mankind. And it seems that both of them are correct. And in fact, the second one is also definitely one of those special reasons why Imam Ali alayhi salam was aware of this day and age.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the situation that the Muslim Ummah is facing today and the degradation and the denigration at which it has reached, unfortunately, is something that Imam Ali alayhi salam was aware of. And this is probably because of the... Of course, he has a connection with the realm of the unseen, so he can know that. But apart from that, he's deep... A connection with the Quran and with the laws and rules that govern the progress of mankind. Because of that knowledge that he had with regards to these rules and laws and principles that govern the universe and the Islamic world and the people's progress, because he knew these things and he knew how societies, plummet and how they grow, he knew these things. Therefore, he had already seen those signs that were the reasons. So he already saw those signs that according to those deep levels of understanding that he had regarding the universe, he knew that now is the time that the Muslim Ummah is falling. It's going lower and lower. He realized the position in which the Muslim Ummah was falling into, and therefore he comes and says that the situation now means that there has to be a very major change. And his prediction about what will happen to the future of the Muslim Ummah is completely correct. But of course, with following those principles and those rules and those special right steps, then of course the Ummah can be saved from that. So Imam Ali alayhi salam took these steps, these strategies in a final attempt to save the Muslim Ummah from complete destruction. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak has warned Conservative Party members against fantasy economics. Sunak has pledged to slash taxes by 20% by the end of the decade in a last-gasp pitch to Conservative members, with the first ballot set to drop in the leadership race. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's chief political correspondent, Jessica Elgott. The piece is titled, Rishi Sunak Pledges 20% Tax Cut by End of Decade in Last Gasp Pitch to Members. Stay with us for more of Jessica Elgott's article. In Britain, former Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak has warned Conservative Party members against fantasy economics. Sunak has pledged to slash taxes by 20% by the end of the decade in a last-gasp pitch to Conservative members, with the first ballot set to drop in the leadership race. But in one of his strongest attacks yet on the front-runner, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak warned party members against an act of self-sabotage that could cost the party the election, and to be wary of major spending pledges and tax cuts, which he has previously dismissed as fantasy economics. I would urge them to treat with caution any vision that doesn't involve any difficult trade-offs, and remember that if something sounds too good to be true, then it probably is, he said. Simon Clark, the chief secretary to the Treasury, who worked under Sunak, said households could not afford to wait 7 years. Simon Clark, a key ally of Liz Truss, said, Liz will cut taxes in 7 weeks, not 7 years. People are facing the biggest cost of living crisis in decades, and the tax burden is at its highest level in 70 years. The former Chancellor made the pledge having faced internal criticism from backers for his narrative of restraint versus Liz Truss's tax-cutting ambitions. In the announcement on the day party members will begin receiving their ballots, Rishi Sunak said he would cut the basic rate of income tax to 16 pence by the end of the next parliament, which he said would represent the largest cut to income tax in 30 years. Liz Truss, whose campaign gained the support Sunak's replacement as Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi on Sunday night, has said she will cut taxes on day one of becoming Prime Minister. She pledged to reverse the national insurance rise pushed through by Rishi Sunak in the Treasury, as well as halting the planned corporation tax rise next year, another Sunak proposal. Sunak has said he will cut income tax by 1% from 2024, a pledge made as Chancellor, but said his number one priority is to tackle inflation and getting borrowings under control. But on Monday, he said he would go further should the Conservative win re-election in 2024 and cut income tax down to 16 pence, costing around £6 billion a year. Sunak called the pledge the biggest income tax cut since Margaret Thatcher's government and said it was a realistic promise in the current economic climate. "I will never get taxes down in a way that just puts inflation up," he said, promising to always be honest about the challenges that we face. In a coded attack on Liz Truss, Sunak said the party's future in power was in peril. Winning this leadership contest without levelling with people about what lies ahead would not only be dishonest, it would be an act of self-sabotage that condemns our party to defeat at the next general election and consigns us to a long period in opposition. "I would urge them to treat with caution any vision that doesn't involve any difficult trade-offs, and remember that if something sounds too good to be true, then it probably is." Sunak's campaign said the 1p cuts would be paid for by increased Treasury receipts, via projected economic growth forecasted by the Office for Budgetary Responsibility. But the United Kingdom is still projected to experience the lowest growth in the G20, apart from Russia, and have the worst growth in the G7 at around 0.5%. A Truss campaign source called the pledge another U-turn following Rishi Sunak's previous pledge to cut VAT on energy bills, a policy he rejected in office. He has also made it conditional on getting economic growth first, knowing full well that his corporation tax rises are contractionary, the source said. The public and Conservative Party members can see through these flip-flops and U-turns. Sunak's campaign hit back, saying it was not a U-turn and consistent with his pledge to grip inflation, grow the economy and then cut taxes. Liz Truss spent Sunday, 31st of July, in the southwest of England with a pledge to remove further regulation on farming without giving further specifics, but promising also a short-term expansion to the seasonal workers scheme. MPs backing Rishi Sunak have privately voiced fears that he will not have time to regain public momentum before members begin voting in the coming days. Though the contest is set to run until September, the majority of members are likely to cast their ballots in the coming days immediately after they are received. MPs who have canvassed constituents say they believe the race is much closer than the public polling picture has suggested so far. Opinion polls by YouGov of Tory members put Liz Truss more than 20 percentage points ahead of her rival Rishi Sunak. But backers of Sunak pointed to an opinion poll of Tory councillors by Savanta Comres, which puts Liz Truss on 31% and Rishi Sunak on 29%. Around 32% were still undecided. One MP in a southeastern seat said the councillor polling was a much better indication of things and there was a significant amount to play for. In my constituency, Rishi is 60 to 40 ahead and they love him in home counties. That is where the huge bulk of members are. In the north, there are barely any members. One senior MP backing Sunak, who had contacted over half of their members, said they were struck by the numbers of undecideds. "The Liz Truss vote is soft and quite easily persuadable," they said, saying MPs needed to do more old-fashioned one-to-one lobbying if Sunak was to have a chance. Another who had polled their members said the vote was neck and neck and very soft. The MP said, "The YouGov opinion polls are normally accurate. I think Liz Truss will win, but I don't think it's all over yet." The Labour Party said the final pledges from the candidates were emblematic of a culture favouring headlines, stunts and division over practical policy plans. A Labour spokesman said, as the ballots drop, Conservative members will make their choice, but the sooner the whole country gets one, the better. Britain needs a fresh start with Labour.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
And every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah. Never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to recite for our listeners a very beautiful and noble Hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, from his father Imam Hussein. And this Hadith is a very suitable Hadith for the time we are in, which is the month of Muharram, in which we commemorate the martyrdom and the death of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his loyal companions on the battlefield of Karbala. You know, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the center and the pinnacle of all Islamic virtues. And that makes his death and his martyrdom even more sad for us and it makes it even more, more paradoxical, you know, in the sense that how could somebody who is such a great person, you know, be killed so brutally and be murdered in such a harsh and merciless way? Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam said the following, in which, we see one of those virtues that Imam Zainul alayhi salam possessed being manifested. Imam Zainul Abidin said, "I heard Hussein alayhi salam say, 'If a man were to insult me in this ear,'" and when Imam Hussein said this, he pointed to his right ear, "'and excuse himself to me in the other,'" meaning, in one ear, if a person insulted me in my right ear and then turned around and asked me for forgiveness in my left ear right away, the Imam said, "I would accept that excuse from him. لَقَبِلْتُ ذَلِكْ مِنْ." Then the Imam alayhi salam continued and said, that is because the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, narrated to me that he had heard my grandfather, meaning the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, say the following: "The one who does not accept the excuse of someone, be he right or wrong," as if somebody, did something to you, and he asked you for forgiveness. Now, regardless of whether, the event that occurred, regardless of whether the person was right and you were wrong, or you were wrong and the person was right, if the person asks you for forgiveness, it's necessary, it's good and it's necessary, ethically and Islamically, for you to accept his forgiveness. Because the Prophet Muhammad said, in continuation, he said that the person, the one who does not accept the excuse of someone, be he right or wrong, he will not arrive at the heavenly waters, right? He will not arrive at the fountain of Kawthar and the heavenly waters, right? So this is one of the noble and very beautiful Islamic virtues, and something that Imam Hussein alayhi salam adopted in his life. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at forgiveness in the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Some observers call it another headache for the U.S., referring to a controversial visit by the U.S. House of Speakers.